Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call. Let's start with the major wildfires burning around California. 44 people are now confirmed dead and 200 people still missing. In the southern part of the state, two people have lost their lives. And in Northern California, the so-called Camp Fire has killed 42 people, making it by far the deadliest fire in California's history. And it's destroyed more than 6,700 homes and businesses. About 250,000 people have been forced to evacuate from their homes all around the state. And what we'd like to do is begin today by offering an update on these fires. Joining us now to give us an update is Mike Moeller. He's Deputy Director of Communications for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. Mike Moeller, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Can we start by just giving us an update? We learned, I believe Sunday was the last real update, that the Camp Fire had grown to 111,000 acres and was 25% contained, the Woolsey Fire at about 10%, and the Hill Fire about 75%. What's the latest on the containment on those fires?
Well, the Camp Fire right now stands at 125,000 acres, 35% containment. Hill Fire is at 4,531 acres at 90% containment, and the Woolsey Fire is at 96,314 acres at 35% containment.
Yesterday, more than 200 people were still accounted for. Is there an update on that number?
Right now, we're working with the Butte County Sheriff's Office. That number still stands. Again, these could be people that are either in shelters or with family members that somebody hasn't made contact with. But again, the Sheriff's Department is diligently working on locating those people.
Can you talk a bit, Mike, about the conditions out there and whether they've improved or gotten worse and the extent to which you hope to have full containment?
Well, I'll start with Northern California. What we've seen, unfortunately, overnight, the winds did not surface like we thought they would. Obviously, we have the cooler temperatures. The crews were able to bring up that containment number that I just spoke about. We still have some wind opportunities, but nothing like we saw when we had the fire weather warnings and the red flag here in Northern California. So cautiously optimistic, Mother Nature on our side, but we still have a lot of work to do. And we switch to the southern portion of the state is the exact opposite. We're still in a very strong red flag warning. Some areas, including San Diego, could get extended into a wind warning through Wednesday, but we're looking at 60, 70 mile an hour winds in Southern California. So really two different weather patterns right now. We're focused on bringing all of these fires to 100% containment as soon as we can.
Governor Brown has asked President Trump to declare a major disaster in order to increase emergency response. I think he weighed in on that last night, saying that funds are on the way. So what resources would that declaration make available?
Well, with Governor Brown's administration and his support working through through the federal declaration, this is going to open up funding through for Butte, Ventura, and Los Angeles counties for people that were affected not only by the wildfires, but also is the cost of actually fighting the wildfire. So there's, when you issue a declaration, there's a lot of different opportunities, but more so focused on the public so we can get them back to where they were prior to these incidents. So the support of the administration, the governor's office, and the federal declaration makes a huge impact, not only on operations, but also in the recovery process.
And certainly, Mike, while you're in the midst of the fight, it may be difficult to address at this point, but let's talk a bit about cause. Do we have any idea? There was an indication earlier today that based on radio transmissions, a PG&E transmission line created a hazard about 15 minutes before the Northern California blaze was first reported. And in fact, firefighters apparently did find downed power lines and high tension wires were down when they arrived just northeast of Pulga by the dam in that area. Any idea what the cause is yet?
We don't. And again, we've heard that information out there. I can tell you that CAL FIRE law enforcement investigators are on scene actively right now. The cause is still undetermined. We don't have an opportunity on cause to be, we have to be 100% right. And these take time. These are lengthy investigations. So right now, the cause is still under investigation on the campfire.
And finally, Mike, smoke from these fires has certainly blanketed the state. Do you have any suggestions going forward for how people can protect themselves on an ongoing basis?
Absolutely. So in the smoke is going to sit down in some of these valleys for several days to come. But one, sensitive populations. If you have asthma, the elderly population, we recommend that you stay indoors. If you can, turn your heating ventilation system off as not to introduce outdoor air. There's also something called an N95 mask that you can also purchase when you're outdoors to filter some of the particulates. But really what it boils down to is, one, pay attention to the news and your media as far as what the danger rating is for the air. But in these type of environments, it's just best to limit all outdoor activity. And unfortunately, it's best off indoors until this passes.
So if it's not an N95, Mike, does it matter? Don't bother to wear a mask unless it's N95?
No, absolutely not. Any protection is better than none, so absolutely. It doesn't have to, but like I said, any protection is better than not wearing one at all.
Is there any way that you've established that you know of that people can help? And how are people doing in terms of looking for their loved ones?
You know, the American Red Cross, which is a partner to all first responding agencies, has established several shelters. They also, through those shelters, develop a contact line for missing persons, working with local law enforcement and the sheriff's department. So that is always in process, a very streamlined process. So the priority for all of us is, one, to for the fire survivors, to either get them back to their homes, to their properties, but to return to normalcy as quick as possible.
And the Red Cross is how folks can help.
Yes, absolutely. If you have donations, you have to remember that firefighters do not go without. It's the firefighters are taken care of through these type of operations. Look at, talking to your local church or community center or the Red Cross. Those are where the donations need to go.
As you watch these images, it's extraordinary what these firefighters are facing, and it's just remarkable the work that they're doing. So thank them. Thank you, Mike Moeller, Deputy Director of Communications for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, CAL FIRE. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you.
And that's the latest on what's happening with the fires, and of course, stay tuned. KALW will keep you posted. Coming up next, gun violence as a public health issue. We have a fascinating panel to discuss that topic. Come back. Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today. This is Your Call. And now we'd like to turn to our main topic for the hour. Last week, of course, a gunman opened fire inside a crowded bar and music venue in Thousand Oaks, California. He killed 12 people, and then it appears he took his own life. Ironically enough, a victim and a survivor of that very shooting had previously survived that 2017 mass shooting in Las Vegas when a gunman inside a hotel opened fire on a country music happening below. More than 50 people killed there. That victim survived the first shooting and perished in the second. Just before the Thousand Oaks shooting, there was a shooting in a synagogue, the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. 11 people killed there as they worshipped. The shooter was arrested and criminally charged. The United States has the 28th highest rate of gun-related deaths per capita in the world. According to a University of Washington report, the nation saw about 4.5 deaths by gun violence per 100,000 people. That's the most recent information. That's 9 times higher than Canada, 29 times as high as Denmark. And so far this year, the Gun Violence Archive has recorded more than 12,600 gun deaths. For years now, doctors at the American College of Physicians and other professionals as well have been calling for policy changes and better practices to try to prevent injuries and deaths by firearms. At the end of last month, the college again released a study with its latest recommendations for reducing gun violence. They see gun violence as a public health crisis. And what's the research behind this? What's the whole idea of treating gun violence as a public health issue, and how are doctors fighting to end this scourge? Joining us today, Dr. Megan Ranney. Dr. Ranney is an emergency room physician and research officer and co-founder of the American Foundation for Firearm Injury Reduction in Medicine. The acronym for that is AFIRM. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Ranney.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Also joining us, Dr. Christine Lane, is the editor-in-chief of Annals of Internal Medicine. She's also a practicing physician in Philadelphia, and she's a board-certified physician in internal medicine. Dr. Christine Lane, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And rounding out the panel, Dr. Brian Wilson. He's a trauma surgeon, and he's also a speaker on issues of race, violence, and medicine. He served as an associate professor of surgery at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, and he's director of Community Health Institute at Parkland Hospital in Dallas, Texas. Dr. Wilson, thank you for rounding out our panel.
Thank you for having me, Renee. And it's Brian Williams, but it's an honest mistake that I'm used to.
Really? We'll fix that right up. Thank you
no
so
worries.
Much. So valuable to have you here, given the nature of your expertise. So thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Yes, indeed. So let's talk, first of all, about the study. And Dr. Ranney, we can start with you. The American College of Physicians released a paper in the Annals of Internal Medicine that was at the end of October. Can you talk about the contents of that paper?
Absolutely. So I actually will defer a little to Dr. Lane since it was published in her journal. But the gist of that paper was that it outlined many of the things that physicians have been researching and calling for, as you said, for over a decade. The underlying concept is that as physicians, we are the first and often the only witnesses to the very human toll of gun violence. We're also experts not just in treating epidemics, but in also solving them. And much of the content of this paper outlined potential solutions to the epidemic. Now, an important caveat is that they made the very clear disclaimer in the paper that their statements and recommendations were based on the best available evidence, and they were very clear that there is a lack of high-quality evidence to guide our recommendations and our actions as physicians. And so a major part of the paper was calling for renewed funding for gun violence prevention research.
And we're going to get into that a bit. It's based on a 1990s amendment, the Dickey Amendment. So we're going to talk about that a bit. But Dr. Lane, she's right. This is your bailiwick. The American College of Physicians released that paper and it recommended, among other things, background checks. What other recommendations were actually made?
The recommendations in the paper, as Megan said, are based on the best available evidence, which unfortunately we is limited. We wish there were more, but the recommendations are basically common sense approaches to decreasing the risk for firearm injury. And in this conversation, a lot of people talk about gun violence, but I want to make the point that it's really firearm injury, because we're also concerned about the accidental injuries that happen because of guns, and people lose their lives and their well-being to accidents as well as, intentional violent acts. So we really need to think about the whole scope of the situation. And the recommendations are advocating for for better background checks so that people who are at risk for harming themselves or others cannot so easily access guns. It advocates for physicians and other clinicians being able to talk to their patients about reducing the risks of firearm injury. It talks about limits on high-capacity ammunition and weapons that are designed to kill, that are military-grade weapons designed to kill many people quickly. And as Megan mentioned, it really advocates for access to data and funding to do research that will really help us identify evidence-based policies and practices to reduce firearm injury.
Well, continuing with you, Dr. Lane, this isn't the first time that the American College of Physicians has called for action on gun violence. So what's changed? How have they been received over the years, those recommendations? And what's changed about what you've just recommended most recently?
So you're right. The first time, I think, that the American College of Physicians put out a policy paper on reducing firearm injury was in the 1990s. And then there was another paper it was less than 10 years ago. This more recent paper, it reiterates many of the same recommendations that were in those previous position papers, but not, unfortunately, implemented in the U.S. And this one has some more specific recommendations about high-capacity weapons and ammunition, and I think a stronger call for more research. It does cover the concealed carry laws, because there is some evidence that places where they're that allow concealed carry actually have higher rates of gun injuries.
Well, I think it's safe to say that after the publishing of this paper, the gun lobby had a pretty strong, let's call it pushback. Dr. Williams, can you characterize how the NRA responded to this paper?
Not a problem. And I should also say that I'm here speaking as a private citizen with some expertise, not mm-hmm. on behalf of the hospital or university. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to mislead anybody. But the NRA put out a pretty dismissive response to what is clearly robust evidence-based medicine addressing gun violence as a public health problem. And the response from the medical community was, they were mobilized and energized to serve the public interest by saying, look, what you're doing is not right. It doesn't serve the public good. And we, as experts in this field who deal with this all the time, are going to step up and say something about it.
In effect, NRA said, physicians, stay in your lane.
Right. Just think about how dismissive that is to people who have spent decades training and learning the craft of medicine with doctors and nurses and first responders who see the carnage of gun violence as part of their practice, and recognizing that they take this home with them as well. So to understand the true human toll of what guns do to bodies is a special fraternity and sorority of people that deal with this. And to have what you do dismissed in such a flip manner, that challenges us at our core about the ethos of what we do as healthcare practitioners.
As a trauma surgeon, you certainly are on the front lines here. And of course, we always pay attention when there is a mass shooting. But as part of your work, you see the spate of non-fatals. I was just reading an article about the aftermath of the Las Vegas shooting. And once again, because more than 50 people were just mowed down in that ambush, we forget that there were hundreds who were injured and who suffered catastrophic illnesses. People lost limbs, people lost bowels. I mean, it was just horrific, some of those injuries. So once again, Dr. Williams, because you deal with the trauma as part of your work, can you talk about the non-fatal gun violence that you're seeing?
Absolutely, and that is a very good point. One bullet with one victim has ripple effects that are under recognized. Mass shootings account for 0.5% of all gun deaths annually. There are tens of thousands of more deaths that result from suicides and homicides that largely go unreported until a big event like this occurs. But for the survivors, many of them have lifelong physical injuries that change them for the rest of their lives. Not to mention the psychological toll when you have to deal with PTSD and anxiety and depression from the injuries. And if you are at an event like this and are not injured by the bullet, there are still psychological injuries that you are dealing with for the rest of your life. It also impacts your families and your friends, your entire social circle. There's just this one bullet, one person can affect tens to hundreds of folks beyond that particular injury.
At least one recent study by the American Journal of Epidemiology suggests that non-fatal shootings have actually risen since the early 2000s, but it's hard to actually get the data because data's hard to come by. And that's what the American College of Physicians was arguing for. We want more data. So, Dr. Rani, I'm sorry, you probably had a really visceral reaction to the NRA response to the paper. What was your reaction to the NRA?
Absolutely. You know, my reaction was one of both shock, but also a little bit of amusement that they were calling out this paper for not being based on great evidence, when meanwhile we know that we have not been able to create good research for the last 22 years because of restrictions on federal funding of this research. There's a tremendous science behind injury prevention. We know how to fix epidemics like this, right? We've decreased deaths from car crashes by over 50%, not by taking away people's cars, but by using good science to inform our use of seatbelts and drunk driving laws and the like. And so I thought it was rather specious of NRA to kind of do this on the one hand, on the other hand thing that, well, you can't talk about it even though you're the ones that treat it, and P.S., what you're saying is not based on good research, but we don't want to fund it. I don't think it has to be this way. I think there is precedent for groups coming together and working together to create high-quality evidence that changes patterns of injury. You know, car manufacturers and injury prevention researchers work together very closely. And there are some great examples of gun owners and owners of gun shops working closely with researchers across the country to do really transformative research that can change the patterns of injury. But at the end of the day, this is very much our lane as physician researchers. There is no one that knows better than us either the effects or the steps that we can potentially take to fix this. And if I hope that if the NRA takes nothing away from this, it's that they should work with us rather than attacking us.
Yeah, I'd say specious is a good way to put it. We are not going to fund research, and by the way, there's not enough research to warrant your research. So,
exactly.
Yeah, exactly, right? And so I wanted to certainly get Dr. Christine Lane in here. She's Editor-in-Chief of Annals of Internal Medicine. And Dr. Lane, we're going to ask you to weigh in first right after our break. We're also joined by Dr. Megan Rani, an emergency room physician and co-founder of the American Foundation of Firearm Injury Reduction in Medicine, and Dr. Brian Williams, a trauma surgeon, a speaker on issues of race, violence, and medicine, and Associate Professor of Surgery at Parkland Hospital, an illustrious panel to discuss the idea of guns and why not treat our scourge of gun violence as a public health emergency. We hope you'll join us. 866-798-8255 is the number. We'll be right back.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A from WAMU in Washington, D.C. More on the California wildfires, including the potential showdown between President Trump and Governor Brown about aid, the latest political and firefights. In 1A, coming up at 11. Stay with us.
Welcome back. For those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp. This is Your Call. We are podcasting our show, and you can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there, and you can sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea, drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're discussing why doctors, why physicians are now speaking out about gun violence as a public health crisis, and we'd love to hear from you. Have you or your family or friends been impacted by gun violence in any way? What interventions do you think might have prevented that violence? Are you maybe a gun owner? How do you ensure the safe handling and storage of that weapon? Does your doctor know that you're a gun owner? There are some suggestions that that should be part of the intake questions that doctors do now with their patients. Have they ever counseled you on firearm safety during your doctor's visit? And what are your thoughts about treating gun violence as a public health crisis? Join the conversation, 866-798-8255, or send us an email at yourcall@kalw.org. Joining us is Dr. Megan Rennie. She's an emergency room physician, Dr. Christine Lane, editor-in-chief of Annals of Internal Medicine, and Dr. Brian Williams, a trauma surgeon and speaker on issues of race, violence, and medicine. Dr. Lane, can we pick back up with you and talk a bit about what's actually been at the root of this? After a deadly shooting such as the one in Pittsburgh or Thousand Oaks, this is the way it seems to go. It breaks down like one side argues for gun control, the other argues that there's no research proving that those measures work. And the fact is there's very little research into gun violence at all. But that can be traced back to 1996. Congress passed an amendment as part of a spending bill that in effect forbid the Centers for Disease Control from using money to do what they called advocating or promoting gun control. It's the so-called Dickey Amendment, named after Jay Dickey, a Republican member of the House from Arkansas. So to what extent has that lack of research impacted physicians' ability to treat this as a public health emergency? Dr. Lane?
Yeah, I think it's just amazing that there would actually be a law on the books that would inhibit addressing a public health crisis. So I think too many people are injured or killed by guns in the U.S. So, for example, gun-related injury was the second leading cause of death in 13 to 19-year-old Americans in 2016. And we've been talking a lot about how a year ago, over 50 people died and more than 500 were injured in Las Vegas. If some mosquito-borne disease caused that degree of harm, everyone would be demanding that public health authorities do research, do something about this, do something to prevent this from happening. And then if you consider the U.S. reaction to Ebola or Zika, conditions that harm way fewer Americans than guns do, though there were research dollars poured into those conditions to learn how to prevent it. Can we develop a vaccine? Can we treat people who develop, you know, who develop those infections? And you know, what we do as physicians and other health professionals is when there's a public health problem, we try to mitigate the harm from that. But the political climate is blocking our ability to obtain evidence to do that, and the Dickey Amendment is that. I mean, you know, I think it's pie in the sky to think that the NRA would ever actually fund research about how to make firearms safer, but it would be nice if they at least would not block the funding of that research, you know, by other entities. And the Dickey Amendment, you know, came to being because of NRA lobbying, and it's really hampered our ability to have evidence to know how we can make Americans safer when it comes to firearms.
And isn't it ironic that Jay Dickey passed away last April, but before he passed away, he came to say that he regretted his stance, and he actually began arguing for more gun violence research. I just find that to be extraordinary. Dr. Brian Williams, you're a trauma surgeon. To what extent do you discuss this issue with your patients?
So the point of entry for my patients is obviously after
the emergency room, sure.
Yeah, they've been injured.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm dealing with them after the injury's already occurred and the aftermath. And I will say that as a country, we need to do a better job of attacking this issue upstream for the point of entry, like go back to their communities. And we can't separate the gun violence debate from structural violence, which are these all these other issues that put these communities at risk for gun violence. Is it economic inequality or education, lack of access to good food, all these things that put them in concentrated areas of poverty that make them at risk for gun violence? And how can we use our resources, our knowledge, and expertise to improve those living conditions so that they are at less risk for gun violence? And then there's also after the injuries, if they are injured, how do we help them recover from these injuries physically as well as psychologically? How do we support the patient and their families? You know, treat that family as a unit that is dealing with these injuries. And those are two areas where there's the need for more evidence and research, but also resources and commitment to improving the scourge of gun violence.
Well, certainly in your role as a trauma surgeon, you must see the carnage up close, but also as a clinician, it's important that you've weighed in to caution patients before the violence is a good use of your position as a physician. But you specialize in a way in the intersection between violence, race, and medicine. And you began speaking publicly on your role after an African-American U.S. Army veteran opened fire on police officers in Dallas. That was back in 2016. The police were providing security at a peaceful rally in Dallas, folks may recall, and the rally was actually protesting police use of deadly force against black men. You ended up, after that shooting, treating seven of the officers. Three were fatally wounded. Can you talk a bit about how this incident affected your view on your role as a doctor and the treatment of gun violence, and how it shapes on an ongoing basis your role of the intersection between race and gun violence?
Sure. The shooting in Dallas, July 7, 2016, is certainly a seminal moment in my life personally and professionally, which forced me to re-examine what contribution I wanted to make or could make to society. And, you know, I don't take credit for all the work that was done there that night. I was part of a team of professionals that were providing care for all the patients that came in. But the incident had all these toxic elements of racism and police use of force and, you know, black sniper targeting white cops, I don't think I need to explain how toxic and combustible that was. And in my role as a black trauma surgeon who was, you know, working with the team to save these cops, I mean, afterwards, I just thought, I need to do more. I need to lend my voice and my energy to getting society to recognize that we have not reckoned with the legacy of racism in this country. And until we do that, this violence is going to continue unabated and escalate. And the use of guns is clearly the most visible, worst manifestation of what that violence can lead to.
I think the fact that politics so often enters into this, either Ranny or Dr. Lane indicated, you know, if this was a mosquito-borne illness or Ebola, we would not only be tracking it, we would be looking for means of prevention. But so often, politics and race intersect when it comes to this issue. There was a story just that crossed the wires today, and it began in a way that so many gun advocates and even the President of the United States has advocated to curtail gun violence. A gun comes out, shots are fired, and a good guy with a gun steps in to help police before the police respond. Well, it didn't happen that way in Chicago. It was so-called Manny's Blue Room Bar, just outside of Chicago in Robbins, Illinois. Early Sunday morning, there is a security guard. He wrestles a man with a gun to the ground. When police arrive, they shoot the African-American security guard. So I just find it extraordinary. Dr. Lane or Ranny, either one of you can take this. Just talk about the intersection of this issue with politics and race and how politics has been a real roadblock to any real advances in curtailing gun violence. Dr. Lane or Dr. Ranny, either one.
I think the shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, where 26 little kids lost their lives, we seemed really poised at a moment where we were going to deal with guns differently in this country. But we didn't. Nothing happened. We didn't get anywhere. Even with that sort of horrific loss of really young lives, and we've had, you know, the news cycle does it. You barely go a week without a mass shooting somewhere, and that's again putting aside all of the suicides and the accidental injuries that happen every day in every city in the U.S. So, you know, and it really was politics that made things not change back then. And the thing to point out is that, you know, the recommendations that come from the American College of Physicians do not hamper the Second Amendment. So after the last position paper that we published, we published a paper where seven health-related organizations and the American Bar Association signed on to those recommendations. So the American Bar Association is saying these recommendations do not interfere with the Second Amendment. They just put safety guards up to make sure that people that are going to be at risk for harming themselves and others, that it's less easy for them to have guns. So, you know, it is not. You know, I think that the Second Amendment always gets thrown up as the reason why we can't make any changes, but there are many changes that we can make that would not interfere with the rights that the Second Amendment has.
Yeah. And if I can jump in there.
And this is Dr. Ranny now?
Yes, this is Dr. Ranney. Mm-hmm. Thank you. That not only that, but many of the solutions that we need and that we've applied to other injury epidemics or other public health epidemics may have nothing to do with guns at all. You know, Dr. Williams talked about some of the structural conditions that create an environment where young minority men are at highest risk of gun homicide. Similarly, we need to talk about the structural conditions that make middle-aged white divorced men at highest risk for gun suicide, and that's concentrated in the western and southern states as well as in Alaska. A lot of the really good research that needs to happen is utterly nonpartisan, and when we take this conversation out of politics and put it into the public health sphere, we've had tremendous success in bringing the two sides together and making this something where there is the potential for moving forwards. We can make an awful lot of changes that will change the face of this epidemic and decrease death significantly simply by doing good research and by implementing evidence-based changes on a community or countrywide level. But many of those things may have nothing to do with the gun itself. An example that I often quote is a study done by a colleague at Columbia where he studied greening vacant spaces in Philadelphia, where I know Dr. Lane practices, and showed that that was associated with decreases in violent crime. There's some really great stuff that we can do to support our communities and our most vulnerable citizens across the country to help keep them safe. At the end of the day, none of us want to see our kids or our family members at risk. And I think that the public health approach allows us to move beyond some of the stalemates that have stopped our country from making progress for so long.
All right, let's go to our phones. Thanks for holding on there. Harvey in Berkeley. Go right ahead. Turn your radio down, please.
Okay. Hello, Renee, and your wonderful guests. Well, the media is constantly telling us that there's two major things that injure and kill a lot of people, and they're cars and guns. The difference between them is that cars are insured, but guns are not. And it turns out that guns are the third leading cause of injury-related deaths in the United States. And the gun industry is the poster child for privatizing the profits and socializing the losses. And when we add up the taxpayer costs and governmental payouts for gun victims, we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars. Why should American taxpayers pick up the tab for all this needless carnage when our tax dollars would be much better spent on community-enhancing social services? And if we have to insure our vehicles, why oh why don't we have to insure the guns for their potential liability? And because insurance companies are a for-profit industry, they will regulate the permits on guns better than governments will. And I feel that it's time for gun insurance to slow down and curtail some of this mass killing where guns are so easily attainable.
Harvey, thank you. I've never heard that proposal before. Has anyone in the panel heard that recommendation?
Well, I think that's a really interesting proposal. And
I'm often, sorry, who's speaking?
This is Christine Lane.
Go right ahead.
So I think that's a really interesting proposal, and the analogy between cars and guns gets brought up a lot. And the car manufacturers, you know, we didn't outlaw cars, but people have to insure their cars. People have to have driver's ed and pass a test in order to be able to operate a car. And then there are certain conditions that people have where they are not able to have a license to drive a car because of conditions that make them at risk for harming themselves and others if they get behind the wheel. And we don't have that. We don't have any of those things with guns. I think the insurance, the insurance proposal is a really, extends that analogy and is a really interesting one. I mean, you need to have insurance if you have a swimming pool in your backyard, but not special insurance if you own a gun.
That seems like such a great idea. Is this not the first time you've heard this? Because it seems to me to be a really pragmatic, practical idea. Have you heard this suggestion before?
Yes. I haven't. This is Christine.
Mm-hmm.
This is Dr. Ranney. I have, and I think it's a great suggestion. I think it's one of many examples of ways that we could have really innovative solutions to this epidemic.
particularly since it looks like politicians are going in the exact opposite directions when it comes to lawmaking around this issue. I was stunned when Congress passed a law saying if you receive Social Security benefits based on the fact that you have mental illness, that should not and shall not prevent you from qualifying to own a gun. I mean, it just seems just wacky. It seems insane to me, if you'll pardon the expression, but I am wondering the extent to which mental health issues are causative when it comes to gun violence. Dr. Williams, I don't know if you have any insight, or Dr. Lane or Rani, anyone who has expertise in this area.
If it's okay, Brian, I'll actually, this is Dr. Rani.
Sure.
This is a really important point to make, is that most people with mental illness, or I should say people with mental illness, are more likely to be victims than to be perpetrators. And I certainly would never want to stigmatize the mentally ill community. Where we see the greatest risk is people hurting themselves. And that's where it's important for us as physicians and for family members to know that if you have a loved one or a patient who is showing signs of suicidality or severe depression, that that's someone who perhaps temporarily should not have access to a gun. But I would not want to stigmatize an entire group of Americans. Brian,
and this is Dr. Williams. Oh, yeah, sure. I think that this really amplifies what Dr. Rani said about the need for research, because, you know, we don't really don't know all that we can do to reduce gun violence. We focus on restricting guns a lot, but there are many other areas upstream that we can actually have an intervention that may have impact. But until we can do the research, we do not know. And we also have to look at the racial disparities in, you know, gun deaths. I mean, there will be 30 homicides today in this country. 15 will be black men. So there are so many layers to gun violence, whether it's deaths or injuries, that require us to marshal our resources, our forces, and our expertise to really find out what can we do as a medical community and as a country that wants to ensure public safety. What can we do to make that happen?
Thank you so much, Dr. Williams. Let's go to our phones. Again, thanks for holding on. So sorry it took us a while to get to you. Thanks a lot for holding on. Call from San Francisco. Go right ahead. Hi, John.
Oh, yeah. Hello, everybody. Thanks for this show. I'm a filmmaker and a political activist from Marin County. And one thing I think this whole movement towards sanity and research around gun violence needs PR. It needs a boost, a visceral boost in the minds of people. And I think what I would like to see is a very, very disturbing film on a follow-up on actual surgeries of gun violence to show how hideous and horrible these injuries are. I think we need a follow-up on, you know, I heard earlier in the show about how people have various complications, even if they survive these kinds of horrific incidents. I think the mind of the people needs to be mobilized. This happened historically during the abolition movement in the United States when the drawings came over from England about how hideous the packing of slaves into slave ships was. It moved entire churches and communities in New England to begin the abolition movement, which eventually led to the Civil War and the end of slavery. And I think the gun violence problem in this country needs something like that. We have to stop romanticizing war and violence. You almost never see the actual injuries themselves. And it's an X-rated film, but I think, you know, the people need to see this.
Thank you very much, John. Actually, you're right. I think the extent to which violence is so much a part of our popular culture, we will sit and eat popcorn and watch someone's entrails splattered on a wall and call it entertainment. But Dr. Williams, you actually know what it's like to treat someone who has been a victim of gun violence. Do you have any thoughts on how to what a countermeasure would be to the to the idealization of gun violence. Dr. Williams?
Yes. I like that. Sorry. Mm-hmm. I like that caller's comment. Mm-hmm. And I agree that the true human physical toll of gun violence is sanitized and largely out of view of the public. I don't know that we need to be that graphic with people that aren't in this profession to make a point. And I'd like to hear Dr. Ranney and Dr. Lane how they feel about that. But sure. Based on what the studies that are out there, most Americans are on board with some degree of measures to reduce gun violence. It's the politicians that are making the decisions about this that are out of step with what the public wants. So maybe that group needs to be more educated about what bullets do to the bodies, not necessarily the public at large.
Dr. Ranney, actually, we have only about 2 or 3 minutes left, so kind of along those lines, your final thoughts on whether politicians need to be sort of scared straight, show them something about what happens in a gun incident.
Absolutely. So I'll be honest. I think that a lot of what we have to do here is outside of politics right now. And honestly, that was the motivation for our founding of Affirm Research, mm-hmm. is because many of us have gone to Congress and asked for increased federal funding for gun violence prevention research, only to be turned down again and again. Meanwhile, as others have said, 100 people die, 200 are injured every single day across the United States. So we've decided we can fund it ourselves. The same way that the American Cancer Society funded the first research on chemo and made cancer a survivable disease for many. Similarly, we can, as private citizens, create the solutions that we're looking for independently of politics.
All right. Thank you. And Dr. Christine Lane, with about a minute left, your thoughts, your final thoughts?
Well, I think in line with the caller's comments, I think it's sort of interesting that this week the NRA itself created the sort of PR that caller was talking for. So in response to the NRA telling doctors to stay in our lane, many physicians were posting pictures of operating rooms filled with blood, their scrubs filled with blood, people with, you know, bullet holes in them. So I guess if there's anything to thank the NRA for, it was for sort of the PR that is mobilizing a lot of people to pay attention to this really serious problem that we have in the U.S.
Thank you so much for a remarkable hour, a remarkable discussion. Dr. Megan Ranney, emergency room physician, co-founder of American Foundation for Firearm Injury Reduction in Medicine, or AFIRM. Dr. Christine Lane, editor-in-chief of the Annals of Internal Medicine. And, of course, Dr. Brian Williams, trauma surgeon and speaker on race, violence, and medicine. Laura Winnis produced today's show. Joshua Wilner is our social media producer. Phil Hartman, chief engineer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp. This is Your Call.